Hey, welcome
Downloads of this
to
show
Objection
are
to the
available
Radio.
on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Welcome to Objection to the Rule, live from Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm here in Violet Barron in the studio with Ori Gibbons by phone. Are you there, Ori?
I'm here, Violet.
Great. And we've got a special guest, Mohammed Atiya from the Street Vendor Project here with us in the studio. How you doing? Great. Thanks for being here. We've got a lineup for you today. We're going to speak with Mohammed about the project for a little bit, and then we've got some news. We're going to hear about Mick Mulvaney replacing John Kelly as chief of staff, an end to the U.S. support for Saudi attacks on Yemen, and potential rate hikes for the MTA. So how's everyone doing today?
Doing pretty good, Violet. Doing pretty good, Violet. It's been a really interesting news week, I think.
Yeah, it sure has. There's been a lot going on with and beyond the U.S. A lot of shakeups as we're getting into the 2020 election year. First of all, let's get right into it with Mohammed of the Street Vendor Project. Mohammed, can you tell us a little bit about the project, what it's all about?
Sure. So first, I'm Mohammed Atiya. I am a co-director on the Street Vendor Project, which is one project and urban justice center. And what the project does, we organize street vendors and we provide legal services. Mm. So that's what we do. So we have a legal team who actually provide legal services for street vendors when they get harassed by the police officers sometimes, or they face a lot of tickets and summonses. So we have the legal team who takes care of that. We also provide legal services and small business services to help them develop their business. And what the big part that we are working on all the time is organizing the street vendors in our city and trying to give them voice in the city government and try to change the rules and regulations and try to push legislations forward to benefit street vendors.
Mm. And how common is that a street vendor will get harassed by the police or by NYC?
Well, it's very hard to tell. It's very common, and I believe it's kind of like everyday thing. So it depends on from one location to another. So in some neighborhoods, we see a lot of enforcement happening every day around the clock, and some other places, things are a lot better.
Right, right. Yeah, I feel like street vendors are some people we see and we interact with all the time in New York City, you know, whether you're buying a hot dog or, you know, halal food on the street or something else, or you're a purse or a handbag, you know, it's almost all happening. That's part of the beat of the city. But maybe we think less often about what these people have to go through in order to keep selling in on the street.
Yeah, indeed. It's a very challenging job and very challenging business. I can tell you about it. So you've seen the street vendors in New York City. They sell food, they sell products, they sell merchandise, they sell books, they sell artwork, they sell all the great stuff that you can imagine, and even stuff that you cannot imagine. A lot of food that you don't even know that it exists, and you can find it in the street, and you can find street vendors provide it. But of course, not a lot of people know the challenges that they face.
Right.
We only deal with vendors when we want to buy something, and that's it. But of course, a lot of vendors face a lot of challenges, starting with dealing with the government, dealing with the system, the permitting process, and the licensing process. It is very, very hard and very complicated and so outdated.
Right.
Like I can tell you about food vendors, for example. So for the food vendors, they need a food vendor license for the vendor themselves. And they also need a permit from the city for the cart or the truck they are selling from. And that is very challenging. Maybe a lot of people don't even know that the city capped this number since 1983. Hmm. So that is really ridiculous. It is so outdated system that street vendors have to deal with. And of course, for like a vendor like myself, I was a vendor for 9 years, by the way. And when I had to start my own business, I could not get a permit from the city. So what I had to do, what I had to go through is dealing with an underground market to rent a permit and paid a lot of money. I've paid $23,000.
Wow.
To rent a permit that costs somebody $200 to renew every 2 years. So
right.
That person pays the city $200 and I paid them $23,000 and even more. So you can imagine how crazy the system is. And instead of if I cannot even afford this, the other option is to just sell without a permit. And that's very risky.
Right.
So it's very risky. I can deal with a lot of bad enforcement. I can just get arrested or get my cart and my stuff taken. And best case scenario, I'll just get $1,000 ticket.
Right. And it's more pressure on you, I'm sure, to make back that $23,000 plus anymore in profit as you're working.
Of course, because otherwise I'm not going to be able to renew again. So right. I have to come up with that bag of cash every 2 years.
Right.
Otherwise, I'm simply out of business.
Wow. And can you tell us a little bit, just give us an idea, if you are going through the permit system, if you go through New York City's permit system, what does that look like, maybe for someone who's new to New York, who's just coming in and wants to sell?
Okay, so now it depends on what they're going to sell. So I think I have to clarify that. So we always say that vendors can be split into like three categories.
Mm-hmm.
So if they want to sell First Amendment products, which is artwork, books, newspaper, pictures, all of that stuff, they don't need any license or permits for it.
Right.
They only need a table and they need for themselves a sales tax ID, which is very easy to get. So the second category would be the general vendors who sell merchandise, stuff like sweaters, t-shirts, hats, sunglasses, all of that is considered merchandise.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to have a general vending license, which is capped, I think years ago, maybe in the 80s or so, and there are only about 800 of them, and only disabled veterans can get them.
Mm.
So not anybody can get these licenses. So the third kind, which is the most complicated, is the food. So you have to deal with the health department, and the health department have two requirements, as I mentioned before. So the food vendor license, there is no problem. Anybody can get it.
Right.
But what about the permit? Without a permit, the food vendor license doesn't mean anything.
Mm.
I cannot just sell out of a shopping cart and say, hey, I have a food vendor license, I am selling legally. No, I still need a permit for that unit I'm selling from. And to deal with the city in the permitting process, it's a dead end. There is no way to go. When you go to the consumer affairs and say, hey, I want to apply for a permit, they will say there is no such a thing.
Huh.
You cannot apply for it. The permit is capped. And that happened with me back in 2008 when I just came here. And I believe I got the license around 2009 and I was trying to even put my name on the waiting list. And I even failed because the waiting list was closed.
Wow.
So I was like, okay, is there any hope that one day I can get a permit? And they said, no, there is no hope.
That's so classic for New York. You know, it's something everyone needs all the time. And it's capped in the 80s, 1983.
Yep.
So you mentioned a couple times now that you sort of got into this from a personal experience. You started out as a food vendor yourself in New York. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So when I started working as a vendor, I was working for people. So I work in a couple places with different folks and I moved from one place to another till I got into the business. I saved some money and then my best friend from Egypt came and we kind of put the money together and we started our own small business. And around 2012, I heard about the project.
Mm.
And of course, as a vendor, I didn't really pay a lot of attention. I didn't look for the project. I didn't go online and say, hey, street vendors organization and stuff like
right.
that. I never did that.
Unionize.
Yeah, I didn't even know that the project exists because, you know, like given the fact that I'm coming from a different background and I had different mm-hmm. experiences about vending and vendors and how the government treat vendors. So that was like a bit different from here. So when I heard about the project and then I heard the story that how the project actually helped a lot of vendors in the
mm-hmm.
street where they face challenges with the security building sometimes and business owners sometimes who kind of abuse their power and their connection
mm-hmm.
with the police enforcement and they call just NYPD and say, hey, kick these guys out of here. We don't want to see them there. So when I heard about these stories, I got really invested and I was like, wow, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So this group is actually helping vendors to get their rights. They are not doing anything illegal, but like vendors here have rights and this group is helping them to get this rights. So that's very fantastic. So I joined the project back in 2012 and I learned about it. I learned what they are doing and I was super, super excited. At that time, we had a big campaign to lower the fines on the vendors. Mm-hmm. So like back then, before 2012, the tickets could go up to like $1,000 fines. And now, after we won the campaign back in 2012 or 13, I believe, the highest fine now is like $500.
Oh, that's great.
Which is great. So I joined, I got involved. In 2014, I joined the leadership board, which is a group of vendors who are actually leaders of the project, who lead and direct the project and come up with the campaigns and all the work. And recently this year, in March, I joined the staff as a co-director.
Oh, that's great. So you're all the way in now. You started from, you know, the position of the vendor, and now you're sort of helping vendors.
Now I'm all the way in.
Yeah, that's great. And was the project itself started by a group of vendors, or was it sort of a project by someone else?
Well, so the project is started by Sean Bazinski, who is a lawyer, and he was a part-time vendor as he was going to college. And he started it in 2001. And I believe the trigger of the project back then was what happened late in the 90s. So when Mayor Giuliani was trying to close a lot of streets, and he already did, he closed a lot of streets for vending in Manhattan and all over the city. Right. And
part of the Clean Up New York
project. Exactly. Here you go. You still remember that? Yeah. That was the project. And he wanted to just close all the city. He doesn't need, he didn't want to see any like vendors anywhere. And yeah, it was a really tough time. And I believe one big thing happened that all the vendors gathered together and they had like a really big action. I was not there, sadly, to join them, but like I heard about it and I heard it was a historic action. They met at Union Square and they walked all the way to Broadway. You can imagine thousands of vendors were over there protesting the mayor and what he was doing. And I think a couple of years after, Sean Bazinski started the project with, of course, a bunch of vendors who started very, very small, like a very small office, trying to organize the vendors. And they did great. It started from one member, and today we have about 2,300 members.
Right. Wow, that's great. That is, so you really are making some you have some influence. You're making a difference among the vendors.
Sure, of course. We are making big differences on like in a small scale, on a big scale also. So like the individuals who need assistance, who actually get tickets or get harassed by some police officers or so, we just go there and help them, and that means a lot to them. But also the big picture, our campaigns that benefit thousands and thousands of people.
Right. And something we were talking about just before the show started was, I believe it's a project that Street Vendor Project is working on now, which involves the vacancies. There's a lot of, you walk down the street in New York and you know everything is so expensive, everything is so competitive, you know. You should be seeing every street front full and very busy, right? But you don't actually. And some of the biggest streets on Fifth Avenue, maybe Broadway, they're empty, and that's something that Street Vendor is involved with now.
Yeah, right? Of course. We are involved with a group called USB NYC, and we are partners with them on this campaign to end the commercial vacancies.
That's Small Business USB?
Yeah, that's United for Small Businesses in New York City. And we are part of the small businesses because street vendors are the ultimate version of small businesses. And a lot of street vendors we talk to, whether they sell merchandise or they sell food, the ultimate goal is to go in a small business and to have a store and to have a roof on the top of your head. Right. Of course, everyone will love that. And we believe it is insane to see the greed of some landlords who actually raise the rents like super high that nobody, even the big corporate, cannot afford it. So we see a lot of vacancies.
It's bad for their bottom line too, right?
Yes, and it doesn't make any sense for us. And we really hope that the city will help us in this and try to put pressure on these landlords and try to get some benefits out of this. A lot of jobs could have been created if every vacant store is actually occupied by a small business. But it's really hard. It's challenging.
Yeah, yeah. Is that are there other projects that SVP is working on now specifically?
Well, now we are working on our biggest campaign, which is Lift the Cap. So lift the cap meant to address the cap on the permits and licenses. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned before, that the food vending permits are capped since the 80s. And we started this campaign back in 2014. So we were trying to ask the city to like lift the cap. Everybody should be selling legally and everybody should be able to go and get their permits and work in a legal way, because a lot of folks are forced to deal with the underground market and some other folks are actually forced to sell without a permit, which is very, very challenging also. You can imagine how hard and risky it is. So we simply asked to lift the cap, and then they came up after a lot of negotiations and a lot of meetings that they just cannot lift it. It is very hard to just have unlimited number of vendors and they cannot control it. And we still don't know why they cannot do this. With all due respect to them, we have seen a couple of weeks ago what happened in LA. It's a permitting process, legalizing all the street vending activities. No limits, no cap. So I think New York should take a look over there. And we were told that it will make a lot of sense if we increase the number gradually. Mm-hmm. And then we were like, okay, fine, that makes a lot of sense. So we didn't have good luck last year. Last year in December, we had a really good legislation, very comprehensive bill that was addressing a lot of issues regarding the enforcement. A lot of people had concerns about vending activity in kind of like illegal ways, and they were complaining about enforcement. And then the bill included enforcement and included creation of an advisory board to just kind of supervise what's happening in the street vending and send recommendations to the city, along with more permits gradually over 10 years. And then at the last minute, the bill died. And of course, we learned that the main reason for it was the mayor, who actually said he cannot support this bill and he still want to have some conversations, and we're still not clear what exactly the mayor wants. So right now what we are working on to try to push the same legislation again, and this year, September, we just had a similar bill reintroduced. Mm. So it was reintroduced by Councilmember Shin, who is a great supporter. Mm. And so far we have 24 council members who actually signed them. I would love to name them all, but like 24 is a lot.
Right.
I want to thank all of them. And yeah, we just had a lot of meetings with many council members who actually support our effort and support this bill. And they think that now is the right time to move this forward.
Right.
We cannot wait anymore. So we just hope that the mayor also will pay attention to this and actually try to help us to get this bill passed, because we really need it.
Yeah, it seems like a no-brainer for New York. You know, there's no reason why people shouldn't be allowed to legitimately work in the city. There's certainly demand and there's need.
Yep.
You wonder what... It's mysterious, right, that Mayor de Blasio... let it go. Like, what is stopping him?
It's very mysterious. We asked him many times in a very direct way, and like, mayor, what is it? What would you like to see in the bill so you can support it? And the mayor is always asking, like, hey, we want to make sure to protect the brick and mortar. We want to make sure to protect small businesses, which, like, when you give it a thought, what that even means. Like, street vendors do not compete with the brick and mortar. That's a very different experience. They sell different products for different prices. They have different customers.
Right.
Like, whoever is buying a $5 halal food platter in the street, they're not going to buy like $15 or $20 platter in some other restaurant.
Sure.
So it's a very different experience, but we still don't know what the mayor actually wants. We were trying to get that answer from him clear, but we didn't. We didn't succeed.
Right. Well, we
in
hope
getting
you.
This answer.
Yeah, we hope you get further this time. I wanted to open it up to Ori to see if Ori has any questions.
I think that's really interesting to hear the struggles that this community of business owners has had with, you know, city government. It kind of parallels to some of the things with the taxi industry. I'm curious to know what other reforms you would like to see, kind of what were some of the things that were included in that bill that you were speaking of, that would really benefit, you know, street vendors across the city.
Well, so I believe that the main thing now with the permits, because, you know, what we are dealing with now is so inefficient. So that's our primary concern. But of course, what else can be addressed is to review a lot of vendors' regulations that actually hasn't been updated since the 70s. So I can tell you that a lot of streets in New York City and a lot of rules and restrictions were put in place back in the 70s and the 80s that doesn't make any sense today. So for example, I can give you a list of streets that is restricted for vending because of congestion. And when you walk over there, there is absolutely no congestion. Some streets are closed for like 16 hours every day. So can you imagine that there's this block is actually 16 hours super busy that cannot have vending activity on it? Right. It doesn't really make any sense. Along with a lot of other restrictions that street vendors have to deal with. Stuff like vendors have to be 20 feet away from all entrances, like building entrances and store entrances. Maybe back in the 70s, that made sense since there was not as many stores and as many entrances as so you can actually find a lot of legal spots. But today, if you walk down Manhattan and you just see a lot of stores and a lot of restaurants, a lot of places, they have entrances everywhere. So even when the street is not restricted and that's a legal spot, you cannot actually find a legal spot that comply with this specific right. rule. So a lot of rules and regulations we believe don't make sense and makes vending impossible. So we just try to change that and make vending a lot easier. I can give you one little example that one rule says that all the items should be kept inside or under the cart. So imagine, and I had this experience before, so when I sell hot dogs on a hot dog cart and I put a box of pretzels on the top of the cart, that's a violation. And I got a ticket for that before. So you can imagine that the rules are too old this way.
Right. New York is a different city than it was in the 80s.
Indeed, and I really hope that our elected officials will take a look at that and like see, yeah, that's been a while since we took a look at these rules and regulations. Let's revisit them again.
Right, that's great. Well, Mohammed. Oh, sorry, Ori.
No, I think I'm the last thing before we go. I'm just curious to know just the size of the street vendor community, thinking of, you know, all the different types of vendors we see, is there any estimates on just how large the community is?
Well, the estimate is about 20,000 street vendors in New York City selling different products and all over the five boroughs.
It's a small city.
It's a small city and it got 20,000 people. You see that? 20,000 right. people selling in the streets.
Wow. Well, Mohammed, this is great. If people are listening and they want to get involved, they want to help out, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, sure. So first you can visit our website and it will be so informative to you. So it's www.streetvendor.org and you can follow up in social media. Just type Street Vendor Project. Luckily, not really luckily, like I'll just say we are the only organization that works for street vendors in New York City. So you cannot get us confused with any other organization. You can just type Street Vendor Project and you will find us all over the social media and you're going to find our website. So please try to help us, try to support street vendors, your local vendor. And if you really want to get involved, just like our page in social media and you will learn a lot about what's happening in the city.
That's great. Thank you so much, Mohammed. It's so interesting and so important to hear about something that affects lots of people in New York. So we're going to take a little break. Next up, we have national news, and we're going to hear about Mick Mulvaney replacing John Kelly, as well as a couple triumphs and failures for state governments. Don't go away. Tewuliga bona bona ndisebenzisene. Sumana kozo. Dumuni muna banso. Chase on the ball,
adimina ina lale mangame abe una ay way ina foka satoni jaga jaga zatote manam ko dum wuli kala ka krete krete san jurice ka wo yele wo pafe ka wo pia kan wurane ntu chei sama rabo na bona wo wo che wuli ka bona bona kin se bindi Surota bolengono we nanke sekese tuguni sani la luje mano kanyi ngalike asubana deni walimi unituma ki walet leni yororo iberena jaga jaga leni yorota iwale nye soroti da chesa mabu mabu na wo chewuli kabu na bu na kisheri luje. Ina lale mangame fabe una ay way ina foka satoni jaga jaga zatoka manam ko dum wuli kala ka krete krete san jurice ka wo yele wo kofe ka wo pia kan wurane ntu che sama ngabo na bona wo che wuli ka bona bona. Surota bolengono we nanke sekese tuguni sanila luche mano kanyin ngalike asubana deni walimi unituma ki walet leni yororo iberena jaga jaga leni yorota iwale nye sotila chesa manabo nabuna uwo chewuliga buna buna ndisheri ndisheri kangari leni kangari lele nyimmala meninge kangari lele kangari 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 kangari.
Hey, welcome back to Objection to the Rule. I'm Violet. We've got Ori on the phone, and we'll get into some national news. This week we learned that White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, who is sometimes regarded as the adult in the room for Trump's White House, will be leaving at the start of 2019. Former White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney is tapped to replace him as the acting chief of staff. And according to CNBC, Mulvaney himself requested the acting title, as well as a clear exit if need be. So, questions about this. Kelly is not the only one on the chopping block as Trump shakes things up before his 2020 campaign. That's not uncommon, but what he was brought in to restore or maybe to create order among a largely inexperienced staff. Ori, I'm curious, what's our verdict on Kelly's role ultimately and on his leaving?
Well, I think that, you know, the issues about his role or how he's performed are evident in all of the chaotic things that have really happened under his being at the helm as chief of staff. I think it's interesting that, you know, we know that he was kind of on the radar for a long time and that this really isn't surprising news. You know, so I think we've come to know that this has been a very much an administration about shakeup, an administration about, you know, kind of changing the guard if things aren't working or if, you know, the president does not think that things are being done in the way that he feels they should be done.
Right.
So I guess it's not surprising at all that he's going. I think it's following all of the same ways that other people from this administration have gone. They may have been under the radar for a little bit. He might get some praise at some point. Then there's going to be some sort of scandal, and then he's going to be the worst person ever.
Yeah.
And then he's, like, out the door, you know?
Right. Yeah. there's a great cartoon, I guess it's probably a New Yorker cartoon, where it's sort of a assembly line for Trump's administration. First, he's sort of shaking your hand, and he's all happy, and then he's unhappy, and the newcomer is deeply unhappy. And then the last frame is he's just stabbing him in the back and greeting the new the newest newcomer to the administration.
Yeah. I don't know what that says.
Probably not anything good. So midterm shakeups, not uncommon in themselves, but it's unusual for there to be so few people who want to step in. Chris Christie publicly removed his name this week, saying that he did not want to be considered by Trump for the position. So what's going on there? What are people saying if they're saying, I don't even want to be considered for this prominent position in the administration?
I think it's pretty obvious what people are saying. I mean, if it's a job that somebody wants, you're going to have competition for it. When you have people, and Chris Christie wasn't the only person that removed himself from consideration. I believe there was another person. But I think when you have people that don't want to fill these what were highly regarded roles, very esteemed roles within the administration, it says something about their feelings and about their security in that role. Again, going back to the turnover that's happened in this administration. So maybe it's just not a feeling that this is the right role for anyone who wants to have longevity in their political career. Right. That could be a possibility. Maybe people don't want to be aligned with the president and his administration. That's a possibility. But it could just be that the role could be so much, so demanding, so much to handle with how much transition there's been and all of the different activities, that maybe it's just not desirable. Despite the fact, of who's in the office.
Right. Technically demanding, probably, as well as psychologically demanding. You're dealing with an unpredictable boss, essentially, and with a staff who sort of moves according to his whims. Another consideration might be a concern about all of the investigations going on around the Trump administration and the questions of corruption that are plaguing so many of the members. The head of the environmental groups recently was forced out due to questions of his spending. We're getting a lot of questions into how these people are performing their roles and ethics violations, and it may be that people who have ambitions, as you were saying, don't want to touch this particular administration. Meanwhile, in Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker signed his state lawmakers' lame duck bills into law as one of his last moves as governor. Laws that will, among other things, curb early voting, limit incoming Democratic Governor Tony Evers' power to pass laws and make appointments, and prevent the state from withdrawing from a lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act. And critics of Walker have said that he's going against the will of the people in this state. And I'm wondering, could this backfire on his political ambitions? He's sort of being a hardliner. He's going with his state legislators' position over the incoming Democrat and blocking him. But I wonder if this is truly the will of the people. Will this go against Walker ultimately?
Well, I don't know what Scott Walker's future ambitions are. I don't know if he wants to go for federal office or something like that. I know. But I do think that it's an interesting move, and it seems very much against what people would want, considering the turnout of that election. So I would be interested to see if they continue to vote more democratically in the future, maybe force more changeovers in their state legislature in the upcoming elections. I think that's something to watch out for. Right. And that would indicate whether or not it's really a turning of the tide of the people, or if it's just wanting to kind of referendum on Trump, which is what a lot of people are saying with some of these shifts in the election. But I, as far as what it could do with Scott Walker, I don't know. I think it's really, it seems kind of low brow of an act to limit powers of the incoming administration just because you didn't win. But
right. It's, you know, a lot of the charges are that in Wisconsin and Michigan, where similar things are happening, that Republican legislatures are acting as sore losers. You know, they won't accept that they will be transferring power, so they're trying to avoid it.
Well, and I think it's, you know, using the law to benefit your causes. I think that, you know, these laws are framed not to protect the interests of, you know, the general population, but to protect interests a lot of times of the people who are funding these campaigns.
Right.
There's a lot of power in that ability to legislate, and there have been some landmark legislation pieces that have only been able to get through because of a certain administration being in power, whether that's the Republicans or the Democrats. So the control of that power is of the essence of any party that has it. I really, again, like to see what happens at the polls.
Right. And, you know, if that's the case, it also begs the question, in a purple state like Wisconsin, is it just going to flip, you know, every 2 years or every 4 years when there's an election year? Is the underdog going to take power and just change as much as they possibly can?
Probably.
another question is, you know, these new rules are based on Republicans not wanting to cede control to a new Democratic governor. Could this, if these rules prove to be longstanding, could it backfire for Republicans? Could if a Democratic legislature wins office in Wisconsin in the future, is that going to spell trouble for a Republican who's wanting to reverse some you know, labor protections and stuff like that?
Oh, I think it absolutely could. I mean, I think you're going to, you know, use those tools if they're available. And I would imagine that the Democrats would be itching to gain control of the legislature so that they could do just that, to put forth more, you know, measures that are underneath their ideology. So I wouldn't imagine that it would be any different under the Democrats. They might not have put this law forward, but I can't even say that for certain.
Right. Right. So, meanwhile, in New York, two major new budgets came up this week. First, the MTA board approved a $17 billion budget that may include the sixth fare hike since 2009, which will be up to $3 for MetroCard rides. The board threatened to massively restructure the MTA as a fix for its intense bureaucracy, as well as dubious budgeting. You know, the board doesn't approve of a budget that will raise MetroCard rates as a fix for deficits. So, first of all, you know, you got to ask every time the MetroCard goes up, what's that going to mean for New Yorkers? And what's that going to, what new challenges might that bring up?
Well, anytime you raise the prices of something so vital as the subway, it's going to affect people. You know, that's $1 for every 4 subway rides, I believe, at 275 now. So, you know, it's going to affect people, and it's especially people that are lower income or, you know, have to use the subway regularly for commuting purposes and things like that, which many New Yorkers obviously do. I'm interested. I have not looked at this budget. You know, the MTA having a $17 billion budget is just astounding to me. That's bigger than, like, many municipalities.
Right.
And so the idea that there's so much spending within the MTA to warrant such an exorbitant amount of money, That's the annual budget? That's just crazy. But regardless, I'm interested to look at what is being spent. I'm particularly interested, the MTA has a whole police force, which is that you know, how much of that is the budget, and is that a necessary expense?
Right.
So what are, I feel like there's a lot of, there's a lot of referendum that unfortunately does not happen on the MTA because it's an authority and it's not an entity of the city or the state. So normally we would have referendum over the budget process. Unfortunately, with the MTA, we do not. But we're subject to, you know, its spending as a part of our tax structure, which is, we have to look at that as well. So those are, the, I mean, that's the impact. It's not only going to be a, you know, it's going to be that direct impact of the fare hike, but it's going to be the impact of this budget and the amount of money that the city and the state is asked to fund, and by proxy, we're asked to fund.
Right. Yeah, you know, you got to wonder if a major restructuring of the MTA isn't in order after all this. It's a huge budget, and if it doesn't even cover what it needs to cover without raising the MetroCard fares, then, yeah, is it the police force? Is there some weird budgetary spending going on that's not clearly a part of the MTA's running? Meanwhile, we've got all of these repairs going on and not sufficient infrastructure to cover it. So it's really, it's a lot that's not answered here, and it may require some reorganizing in order to fix it. Another major budget that came out this week was Mayor Bill de Blasio announced a 10-year plan that would fix $24 billion worth of problems in New York City Housing Authority system. The plan includes selling air rights around NYCHA buildings, developing on NYCHA land, and fixing the services, infrastructure, and maintenance to keep buildings running better. You know, it would the proposal would include having maintenance actually work on nights and weekends. Right now, it's a Monday through Friday system, which doesn't come close to addressing NYCHA residents' needs. You know, it's they're getting some support from affordable housing advocates, but they're also getting some flack for selling the air rights and for allowing for development of market rate housing to happen on NYCHA soil. So I'm curious, like, how do we think that's going to even out? What's that going to mean for NYCHA residents or for affordable housing in New York?
So I'm interested to know if they're going to, does this mean like the destruction of any current NYCHA properties, or is this just land surrounding them? Because I feel like those could be two different things.
Yeah, that's a good point. From what I read, it seemed like it was NYCHA land that wasn't currently being used. I'm not sure if there's a mixed rate thing.
Yeah, I feel like there's look, these properties are some of the largest, I can't say some of the largest, but these properties are very large. If there's unused land, I feel like if the city could somehow capitalize off of that to put more money to make the quality of life better for the people that are living in the NYCHA properties, that would be amazing. If that's how this would actually go down is the question. I think that when we put this into developer hands, there's the risk of the benefits that were proposed actually not coming true. So, you know, will the NYCHA residents benefit? Will that mean that their repairs will get done? The standard of living will be better. They'll get access to more resources. I think if those things could be assured and there's not going to be displacement of people, then figure out how to get this money into the system. I think that might be a viable way. Air rights, These are some of the largest buildings. So are they talking about putting up, you know, five more floors on top of a NYCHA property and building a secondary elevator for luxury apartments?
The poor door again, right?
Exactly, yeah. Which, you know, they've tried it. So I don't think anything like that necessarily would be good for the community because, you know, we don't want to further perpetuate the idea of the tale of two cities, right, in people's purview.
I'm sorry, the perpetuate what?
The idea of the tale, like, continue to perpetuate the tale of two cities,
uh-huh,
you know?
Right. Right. Well, once upon a time, we had a governor and a mayor who were saying that they were going to end the Tale of Two Cities. So I wonder what happened to that.
Once upon a time.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to imagine a situation where public property and public systems are given over to private interests, and that ends well for the people the systems are trying to serve. You know, we have privatized prisons, privatized schools and universities, and that almost always means that people are getting the short shrift.
The writing has been on the wall when you put it in that perspective, especially, you know, the privatization of public institutions. It really does not bode well.
Right. Yeah. So we're going to hear a little bit about international news coming up next. Meanwhile, we'll have some music. We've got Anna Tiju coming up on Radio Free Brooklyn. Don't go away.
Cuando las serpientes evolucionaron, más rápido que muchos venenos. Noten la diferencia entre una serpiente venenosa y otra que no lo es, por las marcas que deja.
1970. Nací un día de junio del año 77, planeta Mercurio y el año de la serpiente. Signo patente tatuado y en mi frente que en el vientre de mi madre marcaba el paso siguiente. Nacer llorar sin anestesia en la camilla. Mi padre solo dijo es Ana María. Sí sería el primer nieto que me probaría, que mandó las heridas y dándome la batería. Solía ser entonces como un libro abierto, pero leí la letra pequeña del texto. Como un arquitecto construyendo cada efecto, correcto, incorrecto, se aprende todo al respecto. Saber que algunas personas quieren el daño, subir peldaño toma tiempo, toma año. Con mi peluche mirando lo cotidiano, dibujos transformaban el invierno en gran verano. Papá me regaló bajo mi insistencia un juego que trataba de compartir la solvencia. Pero en el patio hicieron la competencia, fue cuando sentí mi primera impotencia. 1970, 1970, 1970, 1977. No me diga no, que no lo presiento. Todo lo que cambia lo hará diferente. Se la sé bien. 1977. No me diga no, que no lo presente. Todo lo que cambia lo hará diferente. En el año que nació la sé bien. Mi adolescencia fue una etapa bizarra. El cuerpo es batería y la cabeza guitarra. La orquesta narra una tonada quebrada para la mirada de una niña que solo talla espada. Hormona disparada, sobrepobladas de información que cambian temporadas. Caminas encrucijada, cada cual en su morada preparaba la carnada. La sagrada diablada de mirada encabronada. Mi fila la verdad nunca buscó su silla. Mi búsqueda fue mero proceso de pura pila. Pupila de poeta que marcó nuestra saliva. En la cordillera que miraba la salida. La parada militar de paso monótono. Colores policromo, los uniformes de poco tono. De tono mi cuestionamiento, la voz hizo no, no. Mi primera rima que sonó y me enroló. Mi búsqueda no fue para mi cosa de escenario. Fue algo necesario y que marcaba ya mi fallo. Así que tú hablas más de lo necesario. Fue cuando entendí que todos quieren ser corsario. 1970, 1970, 1970, 1977. No me diga no, que no lo presiento. Todo lo que cambia lo hará diferente. En el año que nació la sé bien. 1977, no me diga no, que no lo presiente. Todo lo que cambia lo hará diferente. En el año que nació la sé bien.
Venenos tus monólogos, tus discursos incoloros. No ves que no estamos solos. Millones de polo a polo, al son de un solo coro. Marcharemos con el tono, con la convicción que basta de robo. Tu estado de control, tu trono podrido de oro. Tu política y tu riqueza y tu tesoro, no. La hora sonó, la hora sonó. No permitiremos más, más.
corporaciones. ¿Quién tiene más, más, más acciones? Trozos gordos, poderosos, decisiones por muy pocos. Constitución pinochetista, derecho pues de hilo fascista, golpista disfrazado de un indulto elitista. Cae la gota, cae la bolsa, la toma, se toma la máquina, rota la calle, no calle, la calle se raya, la calle no calle, debate que está ella. Todo lo quitan, todo lo venden, todo se lucra, la vida, la muerte, todo es negocio, bajo tu tonto semilla, pascuala, método se pone. Venenos tus monólogos, tus discursos incoloros, no ves que no estamos solos, millones de polo a polo, al son de un solo coro, marcharemos con el tono, con la convicción, que basta de robo. Tu estado de control, tu trono podrido de oro, tu política y tu riqueza y tu tesoro, no, la hora sonó.
A la calle, mapuches, estudiantes y docentes reclamando al gobierno una mejor educación.
Golpe a golpe, verso a verso, con las ganas y el aliento, con cenizas, con el fuego del presente, con recuerdo, con certeza y con desgarro, con el objetivo claro, con memoria y con la historia, el futuro es ahora. Todo este tubo de ensayo, todo este laboratorio que a diario, todo este fallo, todo este económico modelo condenado de dinosaurio. Todo se criminaliza, todo se justifica en la noticia, todo se quita, todo se pisa, todo se ficha y clasifica. Pero tu política y tu táctica, tu típica risa y ética, tu comunicado manipulado, ¿cuántos fueron los callados? Pago guanacos y lumas, pago guanacos y tunas, pago guanacos no suman, ¿cuántos fueron los que se robaron las fortunas? Vienenos tus monólogos, tus discursos incoloros, no ves que no estamos solos, millones de polo a polo, al son de un solo coro, marcharemos con el tono, con la convicción, que basta de robo. Tu estado de control, tu trono podrido de oro, tu política y tu riqueza y tu tesoro, no, la hora sonó, la hora sonó, no permitiremos más, más tu doctrina.
Hey, welcome back to Objection to the Rule. We're going to have some international news up next. But first, did you know that Radio Free Brooklyn is a 501c3 nonprofit whose mission is to provide a free and open platform to our community? And we promote media literacy, education, and free expression. We rely primarily on donations. So as you get into your giving season, remember your friends at RFB. It's easy to donate. You can make a one-time donation or a monthly pledge at radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate. And every cent is going to help us to continue to stay on the air. So radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate, you'll feel good about it and feel good about yourself. So some potentially positive news for human rights advocates this week. The U.S. Senate voted to end our support for the Saudi-led attacks on Yemen. And it was actually a bipartisan move and included a condemnation of Saudi Arabia's attack on dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. It included a personalized condemnation against the leader Mohammed bin Salman. And our senators were specifically targeting Saudi Arabia's role as a U.S. ally, saying that allies can't just do whatever they want and stay our allies. It doesn't give you clemency to go on the attack against human rights in your country or beyond. So it's the word bipartisan, Ori, is almost unheard of these days in Washington. You know, we've become so split that it feels like senators will do anything to undercut those of the other party. So what's the significance of this statement being a bipartisan move?
So it's interesting because I've interviewed a lot of politicians over the past year, and when something gets this quote-unquote bipartisan stamp of approval, I feel like it's meant to mean that this legislation or this action you know, they've gone above and beyond to make it happen. It speaks to some Herculean effort almost. At least that's what the impression that I get they're trying to convey. You know, it does say a lot that to go across the aisle, so to speak, takes so much effort in this political climate. I do think it is, you know, commendable that this action was taken. And it seems to be in, you know, kind of in, not, I guess, defiance, but in kind of a divergence from the line of the White House, failing to really condemn these actions and speak in, on this topic really in any detail. So, you know, it does say something about what the government will come together on, what people will cross the aisle over. And that is an important thing to note, I would imagine.
Right. That's a good point. You know, the you know, condemnation of Saudi Arabia included a rebuke to President Trump. You know, Trump has so far refused to speak out against Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi's leader, for perpetuating the attack against Jamal Khashoggi. This action in Congress included a historic first use of Congress's war powers to challenge U.S. military involvement in other countries. So I'm wondering, not only is it a reach across the aisle, but it's also a move by Republican senators speaking out in a tangible way against Trump. So even if this movement doesn't pass the House or the Senate, both houses, it's a move against Trump, and I'm wondering if this is an indication that Trump might see more serious resistance from Republicans moving forward in the next year or so.
I think it's a possibility. You know, I think that there were, especially in legislators, there were Republicans that do not necessarily follow a Trump hard line. That have been critical of the president, and certainly there are going to be Democrats newly elected, and also, you know, those that have been, you know, legacy as a part of the legislature that are going to hopefully be more, I shouldn't say hopefully, that are going to be more vocal. I do think that you're going to not necessarily see more visible condemnation or vocal condemnation, but I think you might see a lot more behind the scenes fixing,
right,
of some of the things that come from the White House.
Right. Yeah. It sounds like we might see a little bit more of that going on, especially as the House transitions in the next year. So that's about all the time we have for Objection to the Rule this week. Thanks so much, Ori, for coming on the phone. And thanks again to Mohammed for coming on earlier this hour speak about the Street Vendor Project. Next up, we have What is Love with Sasha Sugar, and we'll see you next week for more from Objection to the Rule. See you soon.